to do so. Bourne reached for the glass of Perrier. The steel door of Apfel's office closed behind him. Within seconds, he would walk out of the tasteful anteroom cell, into the reception room, and over to the elevators. Within minutes, he would be on the Bahnhofstrasse with a name, a great deal of money, and little else but fear and confusion. He had done it. Dr. Jeffrey Washburn had been paid far in excess of the value of the life he had saved. A teletype transfer in the amount of 1,500,000 Swiss francs had been sent to a bank in Marseille, deposited to a coded account that would find its way to Ile-de-Pontoise's only doctor, without Washburn's name ever being used or revealed. All Washburn had to do was to get to Marseille, recite the codes, and the money was his. Bourne smiled to himself, picturing the expression on Washburn's face when the account was turned over to him. The eccentric, alcoholic doctor would have been overjoyed with 10 or 15,000 pounds. He had more than $1 million. It would either ensure his recovery or his destruction. That was his choice, his problem. A second transfer of 4,500,000 francs was sent to a bank in Paris on the Rue Madeleine, deposited in the name of Jason C. Bourne. The transfer was expedited by the Gemeinschaft's twice-weekly pouch to Paris, signature cards in triplicate sent with the documents. Herr Koenig had assured both his superior and the client that the papers would reach Paris in 3 days. The final transaction was minor by comparison. 100,000 francs in large bills were brought to Apfel's office, the withdrawal slip signed in the account holder's numerical signature. Remaining on deposit in the Gemeinschaft Bank were 1,400,000 Swiss francs, a not inconsequential sum by any standard. How? Why? From where? The entire business had taken 1 hour and 20 minutes, only one discordant note intruding on the smooth proceedings. In character, it had been delivered by Koenig, his expression a mixture of solemnity and minor triumph. He had rung Apfel, was admitted, and had brought a small, black-bordered envelope to his superior. Un fiche, he had said in French. The banker had opened the envelope, removed a card, studied the contents, and had returned both to Koenig. Procedures will be followed, he had said. Koenig had left. Did that concern me? Bourne had asked. Only in terms of releasing such large amounts. Merely house policy. The banker had smiled reassuringly. The lock clicked. Bourne opened the frosted glass door and walked out into Herr Koenig's personal fiefdom. Two other men had arrived, seated at opposite ends of the reception room. Since they were not in separate cells behind opaque glass windows, Bourne presumed that neither had a 3-0 account. He wondered if they had signed names or written out a series of numbers, but he stopped wondering the instant he reached the elevator and pressed the button. Out of the corner of his eye, he perceived movement. Koenig had shifted his head, nodding at both men. They rose as the elevator door opened. Bourne turned. The man on the right had taken a small radio out of his overcoat pocket. He spoke into it, briefly, quickly. The man on the left had his right hand concealed beneath the cloth of his raincoat. When he pulled it out, he was holding a gun, a black 38 caliber automatic pistol with a perforated cylinder attached to the barrel. A silencer. Both men converged on Bourne as he backed into the deserted elevator. The madness began. Chapter 5. The elevator doors started to close. The man with the handheld radio was already inside, the shoulders of his armed companion angling between the moving panels, the weapon aimed at Bourne's head. Jason leaned to his right, a sudden gesture of fear, then abruptly, without warning, swept his left foot off the floor, pivoting, his heel plunging into the armed man's hand, sending the gun upward, reeling the man backward out of the enclosure. Two muted gunshots preceded the closing of the doors, the bullets embedding themselves in the thick wood of the ceiling. Bourne completed his pivot, his shoulder crashing into the second man's stomach, his right hand surging into the chest, his left pinning the hand with the radio. He hurled the man into the wall. The radio flew across the elevator. As it fell, words came out of its speaker.
Henri, ça va? Qu'est-ce qui se passe?
The image of another Frenchman came to Jason's mind. A man on the edge of hysteria, disbelief in his eyes. A would-be killer who had raced out of Le Bouc du Mer into the shadows of the Rue Sarrazin less than 24 hours ago. That man had wasted no time sending his message to Zurich. The one they thought was dead was alive. Very much alive. Kill him. Bourne grabbed the Frenchman in front of him now, his left arm around the man's throat, his right hand tearing at the man's left ear. How many? He asked in French. How many are there down there? Where are they? Find out, pig. The elevator was halfway to the first floor lobby. Jason angled the man's face down, ripping the ear half out of its roots, smashing the man's head into the wall. The Frenchman screamed, sinking to the floor. Bourne rammed his knee into the man's chest. He could feel the holster. He yanked the overcoat open, reached in, and pulled out a short-barreled revolver. For an instant, it occurred to him that someone had deactivated the scanning machinery in the elevator. Koenig. He would remember. There'd be no amnesia where Herr Koenig was concerned. He jammed the gun into the Frenchman's open mouth. Tell me or I'll blow the back of your skull off. The man expunged a throated wail. The weapon was withdrawn, the barrel now pressed into his cheek. Two. One by the elevators, one outside on the pavement, by the car. What kind of car? Peugeot. Color? The elevator was slowing down, coming to a stop. Brown. The man in the lobby. What's he wearing?
I don't know.
Jason cracked the gun across the man's temple.
You'd better remember. A black coat.
The elevator stopped. Bourne pulled the Frenchman to his feet. The doors opened. To the left, a man in a dark raincoat and wearing an odd-looking pair of gold-rimmed spectacles stepped forward. The eyes beyond the lenses recognized the circumstances. Blood was trickling down across the Frenchman's cheek. He raised his unseen hand, concealed by the wide pocket of his raincoat, another silenced automatic leveled at the target from Marseille. Jason propelled the Frenchman in front of him through the doors. Three rapid spits were heard. The Frenchman shouted, his arms raised in a final guttural protest. He arched his back and fell to the marble floor. A woman to the right of the man with the gold-rimmed spectacles screamed, joined by several men who called to no one and everyone for Hilfe, for the Polizei. Bourne knew he could not use the revolver he had taken from the Frenchman. It had no silencer. The sound of a gunshot would mark him. He shoved it into his topcoat pocket, sidestepped the screaming woman and grabbed the uniformed shoulders of the elevator starter, whipping the bewildered man around, throwing him into the figure of the killer in the dark raincoat. The panic in the lobby mounted as Jason ran toward the glass doors of the entrance. The boutonniered greeter who had mistaken his language an hour and a half ago was shouting into a wall telephone, a uniformed guard at his side, weapon drawn, barricading the exit, eyes riveted on the chaos, riveted suddenly on him. Getting out was instantly a problem. Bourne avoided the guard's eyes, directing his words to the guard's associate on the telephone.
"The man wearing gold-rimmed glasses," he shouted. "He's the one. I saw him."
What? Who are you?
I'm a friend of Walther Apfel. Listen to me. The man wearing gold-rimmed glasses in a black raincoat. Over there!
Bureaucratic mentality had not changed in several millenniums. At the mention of a superior officer's name, one followed orders.
Herr Apfel?
The Gemeinschaft greeter turned to the guard.
You heard him. It's a man wearing glasses. Gold-rimmed glasses.
Yes, sir.
The guard raced forward. Jason edged past the greeter to the glass doors. He shoved the door on the right open, glancing behind him, knowing he had to run again, but not knowing if a man outside on the pavement, waiting by a brown Peugeot, would recognize him and fire a bullet into his head. The guard had run past a man in a black raincoat, a man walking more slowly than the panicked figures around him, a man wearing no glasses at all. He accelerated his pace toward the entrance, toward Bourne. Out on a sidewalk, the growing chaos was Jason's protection. Word had gone out of the bank. Wailing sirens grew louder as police cars raced up the Bahnhofstrasse. He walked several yards to the right, flanked by pedestrians, then suddenly ran, wedging his way into a curious crowd taking refuge in a storefront, his attention on the automobiles at the curb. He saw the Peugeot, saw the man standing beside it, his hand ominously in his overcoat pocket. In less than 15 seconds, the driver of the Peugeot was joined by the man in the black raincoat, now replacing his gold-rimmed glasses, adjusting his eyes to his restored vision. The two men conferred rapidly, their eyes scanning the Bahnhofstrasse. Bourne understood their confusion. He had walked with an absence of panic out of the Gemeinschaft's glass doors into the crowd. He had been prepared to run, but he had not run, for fear of being stopped until he was reasonably clear of the entrance. No one else had been permitted to do so, and the driver of the Peugeot had not made the connection. He had not recognized the target identified and marked for execution in Marseille. The first police car reached the scene as the man in the gold-rimmed spectacles removed his raincoat, shoving it through the open window of the Peugeot. He nodded to the driver, who climbed in behind the wheel and started the engine. The killer took off his delicate glasses and did the most unexpected thing Jason could imagine. He walked rapidly back toward the glass doors of the bank, joining the police who were racing inside. Bourne watched as the Peugeot swung away from the curb and sped off down the Bahnhofstrasse. The crowd in the storefront began to disperse, many edging their way toward the glass doors, craning their necks around one another, rising on the balls of their feet, peering inside. A police officer came out, waving the curious back, demanding that a path be cleared to the curb. As he shouted, an ambulance careened around the northwest corner, its horn joining the sharp, piercing notes from its roof, warning all to get out of its way. The driver nosed his outsized vehicle to a stop in the space created by the departed Peugeot. Jason could watch no longer. He had to get to the Carillon du Lac, gather his things, and get out of Zurich, out of Switzerland, to Paris. Why Paris? Why had he insisted that the funds be transferred to Paris? It had not occurred to him before he sat in Walther Apfel's office, stunned by the extraordinary figures presented him. They had been beyond anything in his imagination, so much so that he could only react numbly, instinctively. And instinct had evoked the city of Paris, as though it were somehow vital. Why? Again, no time. He saw the ambulance crew carry a stretcher through the doors of the bank. On it was a body, the head covered, signifying death. The significance was not lost on Bourne. Save for skills he could not relate to anything he understood, he was the dead man on that stretcher. He saw an empty taxi at the corner and ran toward it. He had to get out of Zurich. A message had been sent from Marseille, yet the dead man was alive. Jason Bourne was alive. Kill him. Kill Jason Bourne. God in heaven, why? He was hoping to see the Carillon du Lac's assistant manager behind the front desk, but he was not there. Then he realized that a short note to the man. What was his name? Stossel? Yes, Stossel would be sufficient. An explanation for his sudden departure was not required, and 500 francs would easily take care of the few hours he had accepted from the Carillon du Lac, and the favor he would ask of Herr Stossel. In his room, he threw his shaving equipment into his unpacked suitcase, checked the pistol he had taken from the Frenchman, leaving it in his topcoat pocket, and sat down at the desk. He wrote out the note for Herr Stossel, assistant manager. In it, he included a sentence that came easily. Almost too easily. I may be in contact with you shortly relative to messages I expect will have been sent to me. I trust it will be convenient for you to keep an eye out for them and accept them on my behalf. If any communication came from the elusive Treadstone 71, he wanted to know about it. This was Zurich. He would. He put a 500-franc note between the folded stationery and sealed the envelope. Then he picked up his suitcase, walked out of the room, and went down the hallway to the bank of elevators. There were four. He touched a button and looked behind him, remembering the Gemeinschaft. There was no one there. A bell pinged, and the red light above the third elevator flashed on. He had caught a descending machine. Fine. He had to get to the airport just as fast as he could. He had to get out of Zurich, out of Switzerland. A message had been delivered. The elevator doors opened. Two men stood on either side of an auburn-haired woman. They interrupted their conversation, nodded at the newcomer, noting the suitcase and moving to the side, then resumed talking as the doors closed. They were in their mid-thirties and spoke French softly, rapidly, the woman glancing alternately at both men, alternately smiling and looking pensive. Decisions of no great import were being made. Laughter intermingled with semi-serious interrogation.
"You'll be going home, then, after the summations tomorrow?" asked the man on the left. "I'm not sure. I'm waiting for word from Ottawa," the woman replied. "I have relations in Lyon. It would be good to see them."
"It's impossible," said the man on the right, "for the steering committee to find 10 people willing to summarize this godforsaken conference in a single day. We'll all be here another week."
"Brussels will not approve," said the first man, grinning.
"The hotel's too expensive."
"Then by all means move to another," said the second with a leer at the woman.
"We've been waiting for you to do just that, haven't we?"
"You're a lunatic," said the woman. "You're both lunatics, and that's my summation."
"You're not, Marie," interjected the first. "A lunatic, I mean. Your presentation yesterday was brilliant."
"It was nothing of the sort," she said. "It was routine and quite dull."
"No, no," disagreed the second. "It was superb. It had to be. I didn't understand a word. But then I have other talents."
"Lunatic."
The elevator was breaking. The first man spoke again.
"Let's sit in the back row of the hall. We're late anyway, and Bertinelli is speaking. To little effect, I suggest. His theories of enforced cyclical fluctuations went out with the finances of the bourgeois."
"Before then," said the auburn-haired woman, laughing, "Caesar's taxes."
She paused, then added, "If not the Punic Wars."
"The back row, then," said the second man, offering his arm to the woman. "We can sleep. He uses a slide projector. It'll be dark."
"No, you two go ahead. I'll join you in a few minutes. I really must send off some cables, and I don't trust the telephone operators to get them right."
The doors opened, and the threesome walked out of the elevator. The two men started diagonally across the lobby together, the woman toward the front desk. Bourne fell in step behind her, absently reading a sign on a triangular stand several feet away. "Welcome to members of the Sixth World Economic Conference. Today's schedule? 1 p.m. The Honorable James Fraser, MP, United Kingdom, Suite 12. 6 p.m. Dr. Eugenio Bertinelli, University of Milan, Italy, Suite 7. 9 p.m. Chairman's Farewell Dinner, Hospitality Suite.
Room 507. The operator said there was a cablegram for me.
English." The auburn-haired woman now beside him at the counter spoke English. But then she had said she was waiting for word from Ottawa.
A Canadian.
The desk clerk checked the slots and returned with the cable.
"Dr. Saint-Jacques?"
he asked, holding out the envelope.
"Yes. Thanks very much."
The woman turned away, opening the cable as the clerk moved in front of Bourne.
"Yes, sir."
"I'd like to leave this note for Herr Stossel."
He placed the Carillon du Lac envelope on the counter.
"Herr Stossel will not return until 6 o'clock in the morning, sir. In the afternoons he leaves at 4. Might I be of service?"
"No, thanks.
Just make sure he gets it, please."
Then Jason remembered.
This was Zurich.
"It's nothing urgent," he added, "but I need an answer. I'll check with him in the morning."
"Of course, sir."
Bourne picked up his suitcase and started across the lobby toward the hotel's entrance, a row of wide glass doors that led to a circular drive fronting the lake. He could see several taxis waiting in line under the floodlights of the canopy. The sun had gone down. It was night in Zurich. Still, there were flights to all points of Europe until well past midnight. He stopped walking, his breath suspended, a form of paralysis sweeping over him. His eyes did not believe what else he saw beyond the glass doors. A brown Peugeot pulled up in the circular drive in front of the first taxi. Its door opened and a man stepped out. A killer in a black raincoat, wearing thin, gold-rimmed spectacles. Then from the other door another figure emerged, but it was not the driver who had been at the curb on the Bahnhofstrasse, waiting for a target he did not recognize. Instead, it was another killer, in another raincoat, its wide pockets recessed for powerful weapons. It was the man who had sat in the reception room on the second floor of the Gemeinschaft Bank, the same man who had pulled a .38 caliber pistol from a holster beneath his coat. A pistol with a perforated cylinder on its barrel that silenced two bullets meant for the skull of the quarry he had followed into an elevator.
How could they have found him?
Then he remembered and felt sick. It had been so innocuous, so casual.
"Are you enjoying your stay in Zurich?"
Walther Apfel had asked while they were waiting for a minion to leave and be alone again.
"Very much. My room overlooks the lake. It's a nice view. Very peaceful. Quiet."
"König." König had heard him say his room looked over the lake. How many hotels had rooms overlooking the lake? Especially hotels a man with a 3-0 account might frequent. 2, 3. From unremembered memory, names came to him. Carillon du Lac, Bar au Lac, Eden au Lac. Were there others? No further names came. How easy it must have been to narrow them down. How easy it had been for him to say the words. How stupid. No time. Too late. He could see through the row of glass doors. So too could the killers. The second man had spotted him. Words were exchanged over the hood of the Peugeot, gold-rimmed spectacles adjusted, hands placed in outsized pockets, unseen weapons gripped. The two men converged on the entrance, separating at the last moment, one on either end of the row of clear glass panels. The flanks were covered, the trap set. He could not race outside. Did they think they could walk into a crowded hotel lobby and simply kill a man? Of course they could. The crowds and the noise were their cover. 2, 3, 4 muted gunshots fired at close range would be as effective as an ambush in a crowded square in daylight, escape easily found in the resulting chaos. He could not let them get near him. He backed away, thoughts racing through his mind, outrage paramount. How dared they? What made them think he would not run for protection, scream for the police? And then the answer was clear. As numbing as the question itself. The killers knew with certainty that which he could only surmise. He could not seek that kind of protection. He could not seek the police. For Jason Bourne, all the authorities had to be avoided. Why? Were they seeking him? Jesus Christ, why? The two opposing doors were opened by outstretched hands, other hands hidden around steel. Bourne turned. There were elevators, doorways, corridors, a roof and cellars. There had to be a dozen ways out of the hotel. Or were there? Did the killers now threading their way through the crowds know something else he could only surmise? Did the Carillon du Lac have only 2 or 3 exits? Easily covered by men outside. Easily used as traps themselves to cut down the lone figure of a running man. A lone man. A lone man was an obvious target. But suppose he were not alone. Suppose someone was with him. 2 people were not one, but for one alone an extra person was camouflage, especially in crowds, especially at night, and it was night. Determined killers avoided taking the wrong life, not from compassion, but for practicality. In any ensuing panic, the real target might escape. He felt the weight of the gun in his pocket, but there was not much comfort in knowing it was there. As at the bank, to use it, to even display it, was to mark him. Still, it was there. He started back toward the center of the lobby, then turned to his right where there was a greater concentration of people. It was the pre-evening hour during an international conference. 1,000 tentative plans being made, rank and courtesans separated by glances of approval and rebuke. Odd groupings everywhere. There was a marble counter against the wall, a clerk behind it checking pages of yellow paper with a pencil held like a paintbrush. Cablegrams. In front of the counter were two people, an obese elderly man and a woman in a dark red dress, the rich color of the silk complementing her long Titian hair. Auburn hair. It was the woman in the elevator who had joked about Caesar's taxes and the Punic Wars, the doctor who had stood beside him at the hotel desk, asking for the cable she knew was there. Bourne looked behind him. The killers were using the crowds well, excusing themselves politely but firmly through, one on the right, one on the left, closing in like two prongs of a pincer attack. As long as they kept him in sight, they could force him to keep running blindly, without direction, not knowing which path he took might lead to a dead end where he could run no longer. And then the muted spits would come, pockets blackened by powder burns. Kept him in sight? The back row, then. We can sleep. He uses a slide projector. It'll be dark. Jason turned again and looked at the auburn-haired woman. She had completed her cable and was thanking the clerk, removing a pair of tinted, horn-rimmed glasses from her face, placing them into her purse. She was not more than 8 feet away. Bertinelli is speaking. To little effect, I suggest. There was no time for anything but instinctive decisions. Bourne shifted his suitcase to his left hand, walked rapidly over to the woman at the marble counter, and touched her elbow gently, with as little alarm as possible. Doctor? I beg your pardon? You are Doctor... He released her, a bewildered man. Saint-Jacques, she completed, using the French pronunciation of Saint. You're the one in the elevator. I didn't realize it was you, he said. I was told you'd know where this Bertinelli is speaking. It's right on the board. Suite 7. I'm afraid I don't know where it is. Would you mind showing me? I'm late, and I've got to take notes on his talk. On Bertinelli? Why? Are you with a Marxist newspaper? A neutral pool, said Jason, wondering where the phrases came from. I'm covering for a number of people. They don't think he's worth it. Perhaps not, but he should be heard. There are a few brutal truths in what he says. I lost, so I've got to find him. Maybe you can point him out. I'm afraid not. I'll show you the room, but I've a phone call to make. She snapped her purse shut. Please, hurry. What? She looked at him, not kindly. Sorry. But I am in a hurry. He glanced to his right. The two men were no more than 20 feet away. You're all so rude, said the Saint-Jacques woman coldly. Please. He restrained his desire to propel her forward, away from the moving trap that was closing in. It's this way. She started across the floor toward a wide corridor carved out of the left rear wall. The crowds were thinner. Prominence less apparent in the back regions of the lobby. They reached what looked like a velvet-covered tunnel of deep red, doors on opposite sides, lighted signs above them identifying Conference Room 1, Conference Room 2. At the end of the hallway were double doors, the gold letters to the right proclaiming them to be the entrance to Suite 7. There you are, said Marie Saint-Jacques. Be careful when you go in. It's probably dark. Bertinelli lectures with slides. Like a movie, commented Bourne, looking behind him at the crowds at the far end of the corridor. He was there. The man with gold-rimmed spectacles was excusing himself past an animated trio in the lobby. He was walking into the hallway, his companion right behind him.
A considerable difference. He sits below the stage and pontificates.
The Saint-Jacques woman had said something and was now leaving him.
What did you say?
A stage?
Well, a raised platform. For exhibits, usually.
They have to be brought in, he said.
What does?
Exhibits.
Is there an exit in there? Another door?
I have no idea, and I really must make my call. Enjoy the professore.
She turned away. He dropped the suitcase and took her arm. At the touch, she glared at him.
Take your hand off me, please.
I don't want to frighten you, but I have no choice. He spoke quietly, his eyes over her shoulder. The killers had slowed their pace, the trap, sure, about to close.
You have to come with me.
Don't be ridiculous.
He viced the grip around her arm, moving her in front of him. Then he pulled the gun out of his pocket, making sure her body concealed it from the men 30 feet away.
I don't want to use this. I don't want to hurt you, but I'll do both if I have to.
My God!
Be quiet. Just do as I say and you'll be fine. I have to get out of this hotel and you're going to help me. Once I'm out, I'll let you go, but not until then. Come on, we're going in there.
You can't!
Yes, I can.
He pushed the barrel of the gun into her stomach, into the dark silk that creased under the force of his thrust. She was terrified into silence, into submission.
Let's go.
He stepped to her left, his hand still gripping her arm, the pistol held across his chest inches from her own. Her eyes were riveted on it, her lips parted, her breath erratic. Bourne opened the door, propelling her through it in front of him. He could hear a single word shouted from the corridor.
Schnell!
They were in darkness, but it was brief. A shaft of white light shot across the room, over the rows of chairs, illuminating the heads of the audience. The projection on the faraway screen on the stage was that of a graph, the grids marked numerically, a heavy black line starting at the left, extending in a jagged pattern through the lines to the right. A heavily accented voice was speaking, amplified by a loudspeaker.
You will note that during the years of 70 and 71, when specific restraints in production were self-imposed, I repeat, self-imposed, by these leaders of industry, the resulting economic recession was far less severe than in... Slide 12, please. The so-called paternalistic regulation of the marketplace by government interventionists. The next slide, please.
The room went dark again. There was a problem with the projector. No second shaft of light replaced the first.
Slide 12, please.
Jason pushed the woman forward, in front of the figures standing by the back wall, behind the last row of chairs. He tried to judge the size of the lecture hall, looking for a red light that could mean escape. He saw it. A faint reddish glow in the distance. On the stage, behind the screen. There were no other exits, no other doors but the entrance to Suite 7. He had to reach it. He had to get them to that exit. On that stage.
Marie, par ici.
The whisper came from their left, from a seat in the back row.
Non, chérie, reste avec moi.
The second whisper was delivered by the shadowed figure of a man standing directly in front of Marie Saint-Jacques. He had stepped away from the wall, intercepting her.
À nous à séparer. Il n'y a plus de chaise.
Bourne pressed the gun firmly into the woman's ribcage, its message unmistakable. She whispered without breathing, Jason grateful that her face could not be seen clearly.
Please, let us by, she said in French. Please. What's this? Is he your cablegram, my dear?
An old friend, whispered Bourne.
A shout rose over the increasingly louder hum from the audience. May I please have slide 12? Per favore. We have to see someone at the end of the row, continued Jason, looking behind him. The right-hand door of the entrance opened. In the middle of a shadowed face, a pair of gold-rimmed glasses reflected the dim light of the corridor. Bourne edged the girl past her bewildered friend, forcing him back into the wall, whispering an apology.
Sorry, but we're in a hurry. You're damn rude, too.
Yes, I know.
Slide 12. Ma che infamia.
The beam of light shot out from the projector. It vibrated under the nervous hand of the operator. Another graph appeared on the screen as Jason and the woman reached the far wall, the start of the narrow aisle that led down the length of the hall to the stage. He pushed her into the corner, pressing his body against hers, his face against her face.
I'll scream, she whispered.
I'll shoot, he said. He peered around the figures leaning against the wall. The killers were both inside, both squinting, shifting their heads like alarmed rodents, trying to spot their target among the rows of faces. The voice of the lecturer rose like the ringing of a cracked bell, his diatribe brief but strident.
Ecco, for the skeptics I address here this evening, and that is most of you, here is statistical proof, identical in substance to 100 other analyses I have prepared. Leave the marketplace to those who live there. Minor excesses can always be found. They are a small price to pay for the general good.
There was a scattering of applause, the approval of a definite minority. Bertinelli resumed a normal tone and droned on, his long pointer stabbing at the screen, emphasizing the obvious. His obvious. Jason leaned back again. The gold spectacles glistened in the harsh glare of the projector's sidelight, the killer who wore them touching his companion's arm, nodding to his left, ordering his subordinate to continue the search on the left side of the room. He would take the right. He began, the gold rims growing brighter as he sidestepped his way in front of those standing, studying each face. He would reach the corner, reach them in a matter of seconds. Stopping the killer with a gunshot was all that was left. And if someone along the row of those standing moved, or if the woman he had pressed against the wall went into panic and shoved him, or if he missed the killer for any number of reasons, he was trapped. And even if he hit the man, there was another killer across the room, certainly a marksman.
Slide 13, if you please.
That was it. Now. The shaft of light went out. In the blackout, Bourne pulled the woman from the wall, spun her in her place, his face against hers. If you make a sound, I'll kill you.
I believe you, she whispered, terrified. You're a maniac.
Let's go. He pushed her down the narrow aisle that led to the stage 50 feet away. The projector's light went on again. He grabbed the girl's neck, forcing her down into a kneeling position as he, too, knelt down behind her. They were concealed from the killers by the rows of bodies sitting in the chairs. He pressed her flesh with his fingers. It was his signal to keep moving, crawling, slowly, keeping down, but moving. She understood. She started forward on her knees, trembling.
The conclusions of this phase are irrefutable, cried the lecturer. The profit motive is inseparable from productivity incentive, but the adversary roles can never be equal. As Socrates understood, the inequality of values is constant. Gold simply is not brass or iron. Who among you can deny it?
Slide 14, if you please. The darkness again. Now. He yanked the woman up, pushing her forward toward the stage. They were within 3 feet of the edge.
Cosa succede? What is the matter, please? Slide 14.
It had happened. The projector was jammed again. The darkness was extended again. And there on the stage in front of them, above them, was the red glow of the exit sign. Jason gripped the girl's arm viciously. Get up on that stage and run to the exit.
I'm right behind you. You stop or cry out, I'll shoot.
For God's sake, let me go.
Not yet. He meant it. There was another exit somewhere, men waiting outside for the target from Marseille. Go on. Now. The Saint-Jacques woman got to her feet and ran to the stage. Bourne lifted her off the floor, over the edge, leaping up as he did so, pulling her to her feet again. The blinding light of the projector shot out, flooding the screen, washing the stage. Cries of surprise and derision came from the audience at the sight of two figures, the shouts of the indignant Bertinelli heard above the din.
È insofferibile! Ci sono comunisti qui!
And there were other sounds, three, lethal, sharp, sudden, cracks of a muted weapon. Weapons. Wood splintered on the molding of the proscenium arch. Jason hammered the girl down and lunged toward the shadows of the narrow wing space, pulling her behind him.
Da ist er, da oben. Schnell, der Projektor.
A scream came from the center aisle of the hall as the light of the projector swung to the right, spilling into the wings, but not completely. Its beam was intercepted by receding upright flats that masked the offstage area. Light, shadow, light, shadow. And at the end of the flats, at the rear of the stage, was the exit. A high, wide metal door with a crash bar against it. Glass shattered. The red light exploded. A marksman's bullet blew out the sign above the door. It did not matter. He could see the gleaming brass of the crash bar clearly. The lecture hall had broken out in pandemonium. Bourne grabbed the woman by the cloth of her blouse, yanking her beyond the flats toward the door. For an instant, she resisted. He slapped her across the face and dragged her beside him until the crash bar was above their heads. Bullets spat into the wall to their right. The killers were racing down the aisles for accurate sightlines. They would reach them in seconds, and in seconds other bullets, or a single bullet, would find its mark. There were enough shells left, he knew that. He had no idea how or why he knew, but he knew. By sound, he could visualize the weapons, extract the clips, count the shells. He smashed his forearm into the crash bar of the exit door. It flew open, and he lunged through the opening, dragging the kicking Saint-Jacques woman with him.
Stop it, she screamed. I won't go any farther. You're insane. Those were gunshots.
Jason slammed the large metal door shut with his foot. Get up.
No.
He lashed the back of his hand across her face. Sorry, but you're coming with me. Get up. Once we're outside, you have my word. I'll let you go. But where was he going now? They were in another tunnel, but there was no carpet, no polished doors with lighted signs above them. They were in some sort of deserted loading area. The floor was concrete, and there were two pipe-framed freight dollies next to him against the wall. He had been right. Exhibits used on the stage of Suite 7 had to be trucked in, the exit door high enough and wide enough to accommodate large displays. The door. He had to block the door. Marie Saint-Jacques was on her feet. He held her as he grabbed the first dolly, pulling it by its frame in front of the exit door, slamming it with his shoulder and knee until it was lodged against the metal. He looked down. Beneath the thick wooden base were footlocks on the wheels. He jammed his heel down on the front lever lock and then the back one. The girl spun, trying to break his grip as he stretched his leg to the end of the dolly. He slid his hand down her arm, gripped her wrist, and twisted it inward. She screamed, tears in her eyes, her lips trembling. He pulled her alongside him, forcing her to the left, breaking into a run, assuming the direction was toward the rear of the Carillon du Lac, hoping he'd find the exit. For there, and only there, he might need the woman. A brief few seconds when a couple emerged, not a lone man running. There was a series of loud crashes. The killers were trying to force the stage door open, but the locked freight dolly was too heavy a barrier. He yanked the girl along the cement floor. She tried to pull away, kicking again, twisting her body again from one side to the other. She was over the edge of hysteria. He had no choice. He gripped her elbow, his thumb on the inner flesh, and pressed as hard as he could. She gasped, the pain sudden and excruciating.
She sobbed, expelling breath, allowing him to propel her forward. They reached a cement staircase, the four steps edged in steel, leading to a pair of metal doors below. It was the loading dock. Beyond the doors was the Carillon du Lac's rear parking area. He was almost there. It was only a question of appearances now. "Listen to me," he said to the rigid, frightened woman. "Do you want me to let you go?"
"Oh, God, yes. Please."
"Then you do exactly as I say. We're going to walk down these steps and out that door like two perfectly normal people at the end of a normal day's work. You're going to link your arm in mine, and we're going to walk slowly, talking quietly, to the cars at the far end of the parking lot. And we're both going to laugh. Not loudly, just casually, as if we were remembering funny things that happened during the day. Have you got that?"
"Nothing funny at all has happened to me during the past 15 minutes,
she answered in a barely audible monotone. "Pretend that it has. I may be trapped. If I am, I don't care. Do you understand?"
"I think my wrist is broken."
"It's not."
"My left arm, my shoulder. I can't move them. They're throbbing."
"A nerve ending was depressed. It'll pass in a matter of minutes. You'll be fine."
"You're an animal."
"I want to live," he said. "Come on. Remember, when I open the door, look at me and smile. Tilt your head back. Laugh a little."
"It will be the most difficult thing I've ever done."
"It's easier than dying." She put her injured hand under his arm and they walked down the short flight of steps to the platform door. He opened it and they went outside, his hand in his topcoat pocket gripping the Frenchman's pistol, his eyes scanning the loading dock. There was a single bulb encased in wire mesh above the door, its spill defining the concrete steps to the left that led to the pavement below. He led his hostage toward them. She performed as he had ordered, the effect macabre. As they walked down the steps, her face was turned to his, her terrified features caught in the light. Her generous lips were parted, stretched over her white teeth in a false, tense smile. Her wide eyes were two dark orbs, reflecting primordial fear, her tear-stained skin taut and pale, marred by the reddish splotches where he had hit her. He was looking at a face of chiseled stone, a mask framed by dark red hair that cascaded over her shoulders, swept back by the night breezes, moving, the only living thing about the mask. Choked laughter came from her throat, the veins in her long neck pronounced. She was not far from collapsing, but he could not think about that. He had to concentrate on the space around them, at whatever movement, however slight, he might discern in the shadows of the large parking lot. It was obvious that these back, unlit regions were used by the Carillon du Lac's employees. It was nearly 6:30, the night shift well immersed in its duties. Everything was still, a smooth black field broken up by rows of silent automobiles, ranks of huge insects, the dull glass of the headlamps, 100 eyes staring at nothing. A scratch. Metal had scraped against metal. It came from the right, from one of the cars in a nearby row. Which row? Which car? He tilted his head back as if responding to a joke made by his companion, letting his eyes roam across the windows of the cars nearest to them. Nothing.
Something?
It was there, but it was so small, barely seen, so bewildering. A tiny circle of green, an infinitesimal glow of green light. It moved, as they moved. Green. Small. Light? Suddenly, from somewhere in a forgotten past, the image of crosshairs burst across his eyes. His eyes were looking at two thin, intersecting lines. Crosshairs. A scope. An infrared scope of a rifle. How did the killers know? Any number of answers. A handheld radio had been used at the Gemeinschaft. One could be in use now. He wore a topcoat, His hostage wore a thin silk dress, and the night was cool. No woman would go out like that. He swung to his left, crouching, lunging into Marie Saint-Jacques, his shoulder crashing into her stomach, sending her reeling back toward the steps. The muffled cracks came in staccato repetition. Stone and asphalt exploded all around them. He dove to his right, rolling over and over again the instant he made contact with the pavement, yanking the pistol from his top coat pocket. Then he sprang again, now straight forward, his left hand steadying his right wrist, the gun centered, aimed at the window with the rifle. He fired three shots. A scream came from the dark open space of the stationary car. It was drawn out into a cry, then a gasp, and then nothing. Bourne lay motionless, waiting, listening, watching, prepared to fire again. Silence. He started to get up, but he could not. Something had happened. He could barely move. Then the pain spread through his chest, the pounding so violent he bent over, supporting himself with both hands, shaking his head, trying to focus his eyes, trying to reject the agony. His left shoulder, his lower chest, below the ribs. His left thigh, above the knee, below the hip. The locations of his previous wounds, where dozens of stitches had been removed over a month ago. He had damaged the weakened areas, stretching tendons and muscles not yet fully restored. Oh, Christ! He had to get up. He had to reach the would-be killer's car, pull the killer from it, and get away. He whipped his head up, grimacing with the pain, and looked over at Marie Saint-Jacques. She was getting slowly to her feet, first on one knee, then on one foot, supporting herself on the outside wall of the hotel. In a moment, she would be standing, then running, away. He could not let her go. She would race screaming into the Carillon du Lac. Men would come, some to take him, some to kill him. He had to stop her. He let his body fall forward and started rolling to his left, spinning like a wildly out-of-control mannequin until he was within 4 feet of the wall, 4 feet from her. He raised his gun, aiming at her head. "Help me up," he said, hearing the strain in his voice. "What? You heard me. Help me up. You said I could go. You gave me your word. I have to take it back. No, please. This gun is aimed directly at your face, doctor. You come here and help me get up, or I'll blow it off." He pulled the dead man from the car and ordered her to get behind the wheel. Then he opened the rear door and crawled into the back seat, out of sight. "Drive," he said. "Drive where I tell you." Chapter 6.
Whenever you're in a stress situation yourself, and there's time, of course, do exactly as you would do when you project yourself into one you're observing. Let your mind fall free. Let whatever thoughts and images that surface come cleanly. Try not to exercise any mental discipline. Be a sponge. Concentrate on everything and nothing. Specifics may come to you. Certain repressed conduits electrically prodded into functioning. Bourne thought of Washburn's words as he adjusted his body into the corner of the seat, trying to restore some control. He massaged his chest, gently rubbing the bruised muscles around his previous wound. The pain was still there, but not as acute as it had been minutes ago.
"You can't just tell me to drive," cried the Saint-Jacques woman. "I don't know where I'm going."
"Neither do I," said Jason. He had told her to stay on the lakeshore drive. It was dark, and he had to have time to think, if only to be a sponge.
"People will be looking for me," she exclaimed.
"They're looking for me, too."
"You've taken me against my will. You struck me. Repeatedly."
She spoke more softly now, imposing a control on herself.
"That's kidnapping. Assault. Those are serious crimes. You're out of the hotel. That's what you said you wanted. Let me go, and I won't say anything. I promise you.
You mean you'll give me your word?
Yes.
I gave you mine and took it back. So could you.
You're different. I won't. No one's trying to kill me. Oh, God, please.
Keep driving. One thing was clear to him. The killers had seen him drop his suitcase and leave it behind in his race for escape. That suitcase told them the obvious. He was getting out of Zurich, undoubtedly out of Switzerland. The airport and the train station would be watched, and the car he had taken from the man he had killed, who had tried to kill him, would be the object of a search. He could not go to the airport or to the train station. He had to get rid of the car and find another. Yet he was not without resources. He was carrying 100,000 Swiss francs and more than 16,000 French francs, the Swiss currency in his passport case, the French in the billfold he had stolen from the Marquis de Chamfort. It was more than enough to buy him secretly to Paris.
Why Paris?
It was as though the city were a magnet, pulling him to her without explanation. You are not helpless. You will find your way. Follow your instincts, reasonably, of course, to Paris. Have you been to Zurich before? He asked his hostage.
Never.
You wouldn't lie to me, would you?
I've no reason to. Please, let me stop. Let me go.
How long have you been here?
A week. The conference was for a week.
Then you've had time to get around. Do some sightseeing.
I barely left the hotel. There wasn't time.
The schedule I saw on the board didn't seem very crowded. Only two lectures for the entire day.
They were guest speakers. There were never more than two a day. The majority of our work was done in conference. Small conferences. 10 to 15 people from different countries, different interests.
You're from Canada?
I work for the Canadian Government Treasury Board, Department of National Revenue.
The doctor's not medical, then?
Economics. McGill University. Pembroke College, Oxford.
I'm impressed. Suddenly, with controlled stridency, she added,
"My superiors expect me to be in contact with them. Tonight. If they don't hear from me, they'll be alarmed. They'll make inquiries. They'll call the Zurich police."
I see, he said. That's something to think about, isn't it? It occurred to Bourne that throughout the shock and the violence of the last half hour, the Saint-Jacques woman had not let her purse out of her hand. He leaned forward, wincing as he did so, the pain in his chest suddenly acute again. Give me your purse.
What?
She moved her hand quickly from the wheel, grabbing the purse in a futile attempt to keep it from him. He thrust his right hand over the seat, his fingers grasping the leather. Just drive, doctor, he said, as he lifted the purse off the seat and leaned back again.
You have no right.
She stopped, the foolishness of her remark apparent. I know that, he replied, opening the purse, turning on the sedan's reading lamp, moving the handbag into its spill. As befitted the owner, the purse was well organized. Passport, wallet, a change purse, keys, and assorted notes and messages in the rear pockets. He looked for a specific message. It was in a yellow envelope given her by the clerk at the Carillon du Lac's front desk. He found it, lifted the flap, and took out the folded paper. It was a cablegram from Ottawa. Daily reports, first rate. Leave granted. We'll meet you at airport Wednesday 26. Call or cable flight. In Lyon, do not miss Belle Meunière. Cuisine superb. Love, Peter. Jason put the cable back in the purse. He saw a small book of matches, the cover a glossy white, scroll writing on the front. He picked it out and read the name. Kronenhalle. A restaurant. A restaurant. Something bothered him. He did not know what it was, but it was there. Something about a restaurant. He kept the matches, closed the purse, and leaned forward, dropping it on the front seat. That's all I wanted to see, he said, settling back into the corner, staring at the matches. I seem to remember your saying something about word from Ottawa. You got it. The 26th is over a week away. Please. The supplication was a cry for help. He heard it for what it was, but could not respond. For the next hour or so, he needed this woman, needed her as a lame man needed a crutch, or more aptly, as one who could not function behind a wheel needed a driver. But not in this car. Turn around, he ordered. Head back to the carry-on.
To the hotel?
Yes, he said, his eyes on the matches, turning them over and over in his hand under the light of the reading lamp. We need another car.
We? No, you can't. I won't go any...
Again she stopped before the statement was made, before the thought was completed. Another thought had obviously struck her. She was abruptly silent as she swung the wheel until the sedan was facing the opposite direction on the dark lakeshore road. She pressed the accelerator down with such force that the car bolted. The tires spun under the sudden burst of speed. She depressed the pedal instantly, gripping the wheel, trying to control herself. Bourne looked up from the matches at the back of her head, at the long, dark red hair that shone in the light. He took the gun from his pocket and once more leaned forward directly behind her. He raised the weapon, moving his hand over her shoulder, turning the barrel and pressing it against her cheek. Understand me clearly. You're going to do exactly as I tell you. You're going to be right at my side, and this gun will be in my pocket. It will be aimed at your stomach, just as it's aimed at your head right now. As you've seen, I'm running for my life, and I won't hesitate to pull the trigger. I want you to understand.
I understand.
Her reply was a whisper. She breathed through her parted lips, her terror complete. Jason removed the barrel of the gun from her cheek. He was satisfied. Satisfied and revolted.
Let your mind fall free.
The matches. What was it about the matches? But it was not the matches, it was the restaurant. Not the Kronenhalle, but a restaurant. Heavy beams, candlelight, black triangles on the outside. White stone and black triangles.
Three?
Three black triangles.
Someone was there.
At a restaurant with three triangles in front. The image was so clear, so vivid, so disturbing. What was it? Did such a place even exist?
Specifics may come to you. Certain repressed conduits prodded into functioning.
Was it happening now?
Oh, Christ, I can't stand it.
He could see the lights of the Carillon du Lac several hundred yards down the road. He had not fully thought out his moves, but was operating on two assumptions. The first was that the killers had not remained on the premises. On the other hand, Bourne was not about to walk into a trap of his own making. He knew two of the killers. He would not recognize others if they had been left behind. The main parking area was beyond the circular drive on the left side of the hotel. Slow down. Jason ordered. Turn into the first drive on the left.
It's an exit, protested the woman, her voice strained. We're going the wrong way.
No one's coming out. Go on.